Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear how plastics like polyethylene, polypropylene and polystyrene are not just polluting our oceans, but poisoning our birds. We catch up with the Citizen Science Project that's helped to rediscover the golden ring dragonfly. And we send Terry Flanagan on a nighttime mission to Oros Anuktaron in the hope of discovering some moths.
When we left last night, the last thing you said was maybe 25 or 30 species. I know you're only just topping them up, but do you think, have you hit the 25 or 30?
I don't think so. No, we've a few that have to be identified. So there's some micro moths, so there's the small moths, which take a bit of identification, so you need a hand lens. Or what we have been doing is we've been taking photographs and then sort of zooming in on the photographs, but you need a good book and usually the backup of an expert to be really confident about identifications for the micros.
So a very busy programme ahead of us this evening, as every Monday evening. It's a busy, it's always been, this programme could be on 14 days a week if there were so many days in a week. Anyway, Niall Hatch is here and Enni Nilana is here. Last week, Niall, I'm glad you're here today. I was up at Portmore Loch Nature Reserve, the RSPB reserve there in County Antrim. And I was looking at the release of curlew, two curlew. Now, what had happened was there had been fires on the bog in early spring, and there was a fear that the nests of the curlew, and there's only a very small number of curlew left in that area, were going to be destroyed. So the decision was made to take the eggs. This very unusual, I think a first for Ireland, to actually intervene like this.
Yes.
An emergency measure. Take the eggs, put them in an incubator, incubate them to hatching, and then keep them in a large pen, give them food, and get them ready for release. And that's what happened last Friday. And it was a huge success. So they took 8 eggs in total from 2 nests, 6 birds hatched, and 5 actually made it. In the wild, you wouldn't get that many off. You'd be lucky to get that many
off. Indeed.
So this was really successful. But during the course of the conversation and the research and everything else, it emerged that there has been a decline of between 80 to 96% of curlew on the island of Ireland in recent decades.
Yes.
Could it be true?
Unfortunately, it is true, Derek. The decline in the curlew has been absolutely catastrophic. And the declines have been very bad in Northern Ireland, but even worse in the Republic of Ireland. So those figures are true. In some areas, yes, 96% decline in the Republic, 80% decline in Northern Ireland. That's not sustainable for a species like that. The curlew used to be a very common bird. It was one of the birds that we found in a lot of farmland and bogland across Ireland.
It was everywhere.
Yeah. And that cry of the curlew, that beautiful sound, it, for me as a kid, it was the sound of wild Ireland. It was wilderness. It was magic. Magical noise. You don't hear it so much anymore. But most people have never experienced it, which is a tragedy. And its habitat loss is the real culprit here. It's intensification of agriculture. It's the destruction of boglands. And this is one of the species.
And it's the increase in ground predators as well.
Increase of ground predators
because
as well.
Because curlew nest on the ground.
They
do. I was just looking at something there. It was about Scotland, I suppose, but they were saying how much the curlew had been protected in the old days when you had gamekeepers who got rid of the vermin, as they called them, off the land so that the birds like grouse and nest, other ground nesting birds could happen. And of course, that benefited the curlew and things as well. But
yes.
We never had that in Ireland. I think that
particularly when it comes to non-native predators, though, that's been a particularly big issue. So you have problems with mink. There's certainly problems with crows, which are a native predator in some areas. But what's happened is that as the habitat for the curlews has become more fragmented and the population has decreased, these predators can have a bigger impact than when the bird was common, because when the curlews were abundant, they could lose thousands of chicks per year to predators, would have no overall effect on the population. But now we're at the stage where drastic measures have to be taken, as we've seen at Portmore Loch, where they, you know, the fire threatened these birds and they had no choice but to take them in, because those few chicks would represent a substantial proportion of the Irish breeding population this year. So it's hats off to them for doing it. It's an amazing effort. It seems to have been very successful, but it just shows the kind of intensive management that's required to keep the species in Ireland.
But when we say numbers like 80 to 96%, how many are we talking about exactly, and what? How many are left?
We're talking in, well, certainly in the Republic of Ireland, we're talking maybe 100 to 120 pairs.
Is that all?
That's all, yeah. And this was first identified through the work that Birdwatch Ireland did for the Bird Atlas of 2007 to 2011. We found that the species, we knew it was in serious decline, but we were shocked by the level of that decline. Many former strongholds across the Midlands, particularly where this bird was once abundant, were just completely vacant. It's been really, really shocking to see it. And we know that this is a pattern that's happening in other countries as well. The curlew is a bird that that ranges across a lot of Northern Europe and Asia. We're seeing massive declines there too.
Yeah, but more so in Ireland.
More so in Ireland than anywhere else. Yeah, and we got to remember, we are at the fringe of that bird's range. So the westernmost curlews in the world are the ones that breed in Ireland. So when we start to see collapses in bird populations, it often happens at the fringes. Climate change may well be playing a role in this. What we do know that's very important to bear in mind is that the curlew, our Eurasian curlew, is one of a group of around about a dozen or so curlew species in the world. We know that several other species from that group have gone from being super abundant to being extinct almost overnight. So one of the most tragic examples is a bird that's called the Eskimo curlew. It's once the commonest migrant wader in the flyways down the central part of the United States down to the Mexican Pampas. Extinct now.
Yeah.
Another bird, the slender-billed curlew, was once the most, in the 19th century, was the most common migrant wader in Italy on migration. Nobody really ever found out where it bred. Probably somewhere in the Kazakh steppes, would winter in places like the Mediterranean, North Africa. That species is now almost certainly extinct as well. The last ones were seen in the 1990s in Morocco. We know that, therefore, that this genus, Numanius, which is the curlew genus, they go from being super abundant to being virtually extinct overnight. They can't cope with human-made pressures. So things like climate change, agricultural change, ground predators, all of this, they're all hitting this bird at once, and now the battle is really on to save this species. It's really tragic.
Now, talk to me about swifts in County Wicklow, please.
So the swift, well, the swift is another bird that's in serious decline, not quite to the same extent as the curlew, but a lot of effort is going into saving this. Now, the swift is a bird that's aside from some of the other rare species, which we tend to live in bogland or in woodland or farmland, swifts like to live in urban areas. So they're in the cities and the suburbs. And many places in Ireland now, there's all sorts of different swift conservation projects that are underway. Particularly good one going on now in Wicklow at the moment. So earlier in the week, I went and met with my former Birdwatch Ireland colleague, Oran O'Sullivan, who's now the coordinator of the Wicklow Swift Project. I wanted to talk to him a bit about what's happening in the county and how the birds are doing.
The project really started out in 2019 when we carried out a full survey just to find out how many swifts we actually have. Now, we're aware that nationally, through the Bird Atlas, that populations are down at least 26, maybe to 30% across the country. So coming from that background, a full survey was required in 2019, and a report was issued from that, which was submitted to the Heritage Office of Wicklow County Council. The report found that swifts are quite local in County Wicklow, but never in any kind of biggish numbers. They're obviously absent from the middle of the county, the mountainous centre. So they're down the east coast and across the southern boundary of County Wicklow and back up the west towards Blessington and Balton Glass, places like that. But they're very thinly distributed, you know, not to be confused with swallows, which we have maybe a couple of million birds. Swifts are in the thousands, really, nationally. So it's a different scenario. And the report, which issued at the end of 2019, identified, some conservation measures and recommendations. And I'm very happy to report that in 2020, this summer just gone, that some of these recommendations were implemented with regard to swift nest boxes and nesting opportunities. Basically, we found that swifts are quite often located in housing estates, and they basically nest in under eaves, quite often unknown to residents. They're a tidy bird that cause no mess, no hassle at all. So you could have swifts and not even be aware of it. We've found, obviously, over the last 20 years, that old private housing, which is really suitable for swifts because there's little gaps and spaces for them to enter because they nest in hidden under the eaves, these houses are being retrofitted and repaired and renewed and so forth. So the swifts are losing nest sites. And also we find that new housing and new building, unless swifts are actually specifically catered for, which is most unusual so far in this country, new housing is no good for them. So really we identified that public buildings had a role to play in swift conservation. And luckily, because the Heritage Office of the Wicklow County Council is involved in supporting this project, we have access to libraries and various public buildings around the county. I mean, the logic there is that these buildings have a long-term future and they are maintained, and I mean, they're suitable for swifts, they're larger scale buildings, and it's worked quite well. But given the fact in this summer just gone with COVID restrictions, we got some good work done early in the season, that's February up to the middle of March, and then obviously had to shelve things until the lockdown restrictions were partially lifted or eased, if you like, in midsummer. So we did get a number of nest boxes up at sites such as Wicklow Town itself. The County Council buildings had nest boxes. The new library has nest boxes going up as we speak. Arklow has three or four locations now, public buildings with nest boxes. And some of the smaller villages like Rathdrum, Dunlavin have actually taken on nest boxes this year. So we're very pleased with what we've got, working with Tidy Towns and community groups. Obviously, there's more to do, so hopefully in 2021, if we're lockdowns are lifted and we're all healthy and can carry on, we'll do some more work then.
Quite a few people find it difficult to tell the difference between swallows and swifts. Have you got any tips that would make it a bit easier?
Swifts are all dark. I refer to them often in interviews as the Formula One of birds. You might drive an Opel Corsa. These things are Formula One. The wings are scythe-like in shape. They're really strong flyers, short tail, all dark. I mean, swallow is pale underneath, has tail streamers. House martin is white below and has the white rump. In terms of nesting, if a bird disappears into the eave of a house, if it's not a sparrow or a starling, it's a swift. House martins nest outside on the apex of your roof, maybe. It's a mud nest that's visible. Swallows nest inside, a similar kind of nest, but inside in a shed or a barn or a building on a plank. So there's that difference. Good starting point, because obviously when you look up into the sky at seeing flocks of swallows and swifts, they often mix around, but they're a larger bird too, all dark, and these, as I say, Formula One shape, really sharp looking wings and a bullet shaped body. And if you're lucky, I'd say in the evenings you can hear them screaming. It's a nice kind of screaming. Somebody said, oh, don't please say they're screaming, because people won't like that. It's a scream, if you can think of it, a child screaming when they see ice cream, as it's distinct from when they see the bogeyman. it's a pleasant scream, and it really is the sound of summer. If swallows are the sound of spring, I think swifts are the icon of summer for me, certainly.
Oran O'Sullivan speaking earlier this week with Niall Hatch, and you can find more information on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Now, dragonflies are one of our most popular insects, thanks to their fabulous array of colours and helicopter-like flight patterns, which enable them to hover and fly backwards. Now, I've never seen one fly backwards. Have you, Aina?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I even looked up how they do it. And they have four wings. And their wings can all operate independently. And they can change their body shape. You know the way when you see a helicopter flying, its tail is up higher than its head. Well, that's what they can do as well. And they can actually move their four wings independently, because unlike other insects where their diaphragm going up and down makes the wings move, they actually have a muscle on each of the four wings and they can work them independently. It's great.
The way you're working your body now.
Yeah, exactly.
they were the first creatures ever to fly, so they've had a long time to perfect that.
They have a different way of doing it. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
In fairness, they've been around for a long time. They've been around since the time of the dinosaurs. Have they
well,
not?
Before, well, before.
Well,
before.
Well, before. Yeah.
Anyway, Dragonfly Ireland 2019 to 2024 is a citizen science survey run jointly by the Centre for Environmental Data and Recording in Northern Ireland and the National Biodiversity Data Centre here in Waterford. Dave Wall is their citizen science officer and he joins us now with the latest results. Dave, I suppose just to start off, I know we've discussed this before with other people, but exactly what is a citizen scientist? And then you can tell us the rest.
Okay, what is a citizen scientist? Well, I suppose there's many definitions, but probably the easiest one is that it's volunteer citizen scientists, volunteer scientists, not necessarily professionals, who are collecting real data and working on real scientific research, all off their own bat and all for free.
Simple as. So you say to the public, if you've got an interest or if you come across something or if you spot something, or would you mind just collecting a little bit of information and then sending it into us, and we can compile all the information and we can go through all the data and it gives us a kind of snapshot of what's in this country at this time in this place.
Exactly. So for this project, Dragonfly Ireland it's actually a 5-year Atlas programme, but the EPA have funded us for 3 years to look at both the Atlas, developing an Atlas, looking at the value of dragonflies and damselflies as bioindicators of climate change and water quality, and also raising public awareness to these issues, to climate change and water quality. So in terms of citizen scientists, last year we had 450 citizen scientists who submitted records to the data centre of dragonflies and damselflies when they were out and about doing either surveys or doing whatever they normally do day to day.
Why dragonflies?
If you think about their life cycle, I suppose that's the best way to explain it. We see the adult dragonflies and damselflies flying around and we go, oh, that's very nice. And they live for, if you're a damselfly, you live a couple of weeks. If you're a dragonfly, you live a couple of months. And you go, that's a very short lifestyle. But of course, that isn't their life cycle. Their life cycle is mostly in water. So they're a great indicator species for water, what happens in our freshwater habitats, because they spend, for every damselfly, for its 2 weeks flying around the air, it spends maybe a year or two in the water. And the same for dragonflies. They can spend up to 5 years in water as going through nymph stages before they emerge as adults.
And of course, when they're in the water, they're very sensitive and they get their oxygen through their gills on their tails. And if the oxygen levels are lower than 100%, it makes it difficult for them. So if we have adult dragonflies flying around that we can see, we know that the water from which they came has had to be very clean as well.
Exactly. They have a fairly low tolerance for water pollution and also for changes to bankside vegetation and in-water vegetation as well. That's all critical parts of their habitat. So I suppose in 2019, we did quite well. We advertised and we pushed the survey. We had a 97% increase on records coming into the data
centre. Well,
mind you,
that wouldn't be hard because we hadn't all that many before then.
Well, I mean, we've a background level of about 1,000 records per year, something like that, or something just under it.
Yeah.
But when you promote citizen science, everyone says, oh, citizen science is free, but it's not really. It benefits from input of funding, thanks to the EPA in this case, but also time and effort, and that's what generates your sightings. So we had a big increase in sightings last year. Between ourselves and CEDAR in Northern Ireland, we had 3,788 sightings of 26 dragonfly and damselfly species come in 2019. So if you look at Ireland, in terms of 10-kilometre grid squares, we'd records out of half of those, out of 499 of a possible 1,000 10-kilometre grid squares. So we're quite happy with our coverage for year one.
That's great. And of course, not only did you find 25 species with records for each of them, but you got something very exciting down in Kilkenny. The dragonflies are taking up hurling. Well, at least they're togging out in Kilkenny jerseys, aren't they?
They are indeed.
Tell us about the new one that's breeding down there.
I used to work with a fella years ago, and when he didn't see you for a long time and he walked in the door, he used to say, "Ah, the dead arose and appeared to many." Well, that's the story of the golden ring dragonfly. Golden ring dragonfly was first recorded in Ireland in 2005.
No, come here to me. I'm older than you. I'm older than you. Actually, Halby has a specimen in the dead zoo that he got at the end of the 1800s, 1897 or something. So it was always on the list, but never seen again. So it did. It rose from the dead. It rose from the dead many, many, 100 years ago. It rose from the dead. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead, Dave.
Exactly. No, well put, Aina. It was there as a historical record from previous centuries. But I suppose in modern times, if you look at it in that terms, we had two records from Kilkenny in 2005. One dead female, one live female. And then it vanished for a few years. And then in 2008, another dead female was found in Waterford. And since then, nothing. And this thing has been the bane of our lives for years because, well, obviously it was recorded and every year we'd get records of golden ring dragonflies. And whenever we validated the records, they'd always be something else. They'd be one of the, you know, a brown hawker or a hairy hawker or something like that. Never a golden ring dragonfly. So we were beginning to come to the conclusion, as a lot of people were, that this was an anomaly. This was perhaps dragonflies that come in on a truckload of timber once or twice into some location in Waterford or Kilkenny. And we'd kind of come to the stage where we're dismissing golden ring dragonflies as an Irish species. More, they just cropped up as a vagrant.
Even though it's the biggest species and it's black and yellow, it's a completely different colour to anything else. Most of the other ones can be blues and greens and things, but this is black and yellow and huge.
It's very striking. If you think of the Kilkenny colours, you've got a nail on the head there, and it's our largest dragonfly. Black body, gold bands, very characteristic and very hard to misidentify when you do see it up close. But this year, on 1st of July 2020, we got a photo submitted to us from Enda MacDonald in Gertines in Kilkenny. And we looked at it and we went, it isn't. It is, you know. And there was a picture of a female golden ring dragonfly sitting on a fence post up near the Glanbia plant in Kilkenny. And we thought, well, that's remarkable. So it went in as another record and we pondered it and we wondered about it. And then on 20th of August, another record came in from Aideen Kane. But this was a male golden ring dragonfly from Fateleg, just across the river from Fateleg in Waterford. And on the 21st, we did another record from Joseph Frayne, and that was about 10 kilometres north of the Glanbia plant. And since that, we've had one other record. So it's beginning to look like, instead of this being a kind of vagrant that pops up once in a blue moon, that there might actually be a small breeding population of golden ring dragonfly in the Kilkenny-Waterford border area.
And so, it's a dragonfly of fast enough flowing water, isn't it?
Generally, you would expect to find it in upland streams, open streams in upland areas, but these certainly aren't occurring in upland streams. This is lowland water right next to a major river, and there's very few open streams. So we have done our best to try and locate the breeding location, but no luck so far. But we're still searching. I mean, I suppose one question that arises, how can this be? How can you have a population of golden ring dragonfly that were sighted 10 or 15 years ago, not sighted since? Well, if you look at the life cycle of the golden ring dragonfly, it's one of the species that has the longest in-water stage, the nymph stage, where they go through nymph larval stages in the freshwater habitat. They can do this for 4 or 5 years, or sometimes even longer. So if you think you have a small population of golden ring dragonfly all breeding at the same time, well, essentially they do a vanishing act, don't they? They appear 1 year and then they disappear for 4 or 5 years.
Because the babies have to grow up, yeah.
And disappear again. So if you miss them on that fifth year, you've missed them for 10 years, essentially, because you won't get another chance. So it might be an explainer for why we haven't had regular records of these species. But, you know, it's looking bright. It's looking brighter. We've got several sightings now for golden ring dragonfly, and we're optimistic that this is going to be a new and increasing species of dragonfly for Ireland.
Can I ask, do you think there's been any environmental change that has benefited this species? Because, you know, I'm a bird watcher myself, but I take a keen interest in dragonflies when I'm out and about. And in recent years, it's been very notable to see the big increase in emperor dragonflies, in migrant hawkers, and other dragonflies that would be associated perhaps with warmer conditions and climate change. Do you think that's played a role with this species too?
It has indeed. And I mean, that's one of the kind of, there aren't many good news stories with climate change, but for if you're a dragonfly, climate change is a bit of a boon, to be honest with you. Take the example of the emperor dragonfly. During their first Dragonfly Ireland survey in 2000 to 2003, that species was first recorded in Ireland in 2000. And at the end of the Dragonfly Ireland survey, the first one at the end of 2003, all records for emperor dragonfly were restricted to the southeast coast and right along the coast, going up just that corner, southeast coast of Ireland. And there were no other records anywhere else. When we looked at the data from last year, what we found was the emperor dragonflies had spread northward up the east coast as far as Belfast, and they'd spread northwest across the country as far as Galway and Offaly. So they're kind of advancing across the country in a sloping angle to the northwest. And the same has been found for migrant hawkers. So what's happening here is these species are undergoing range expansion. So the emperor dragonfly has a distribution, a global distribution that runs from South Africa all the way up to the south coast of Norway and Finland and Sweden. We're very much at the northern end of its range, and it's advancing now, probably due to increased average temperatures it's experiencing due to climate change, and it's spreading across the country, and we expect it now to keep spreading until eventually we'll find them up in Donegal.
Mind you, the golden ringed one is common in Britain, and it's right up, I mean, it's not just down in the southeast of Britain, it's actually right across Britain. So it's just obviously didn't get here. They don't generally fly across the sea, so maybe it just never got here and now it has.
Yes, it is an interesting one. It was always a species that we wondered why it wasn't here, because as you say, it's relatively common in uplands in Scotland and across other areas of Britain. So there was no explanation really why it wasn't here. So how did the little population get a grip on the Kilkenny-Waterford border? We may never know. Maybe they did arrive in the back of a truck. But it'll be interesting in the coming years now to see whether that population spreads as those animals move. And of course, they'll do well because, as you say, the climate suits them.
You were talking about the results that you did in 2019. I presume you haven't put together 2020. But do you think as people were cocooned and could only go within a short distance of their home, that everything that moved within 2 kilometres or 5 kilometres will have been reported into you, including dragonflies? Are you expecting more results this year?
Indeed. I mean, it was oddly enough, there was very little to be said good for COVID-19, but it happened that because people were restricted at home, they couldn't venture very far. And let's face it, we were all looking for something to do with our lockdown days. We received a great boost in records at the data centre. And I've just spent this morning actually validating records of dragonflies and damselflies. And so far for 2020, we've 3,340 records in. So that's an increase even on last year. And in June, for the first time in possibly ever, we received 1,000 records in a single month into the data centre. So the more records we get, the better a picture we'll get of distributions for dragonfly and damselfly species. So it's always good to see those records coming in.
The red ones are around at the moment, the red darters and the ones with red bodies, which are easy enough to identify. So you still want people to send you in records of these September flying ones?
Absolutely. At the moment, as you say, common darters are doing exactly what they're supposed to do, which is be common. And indeed, they were our most commonly recorded dragonfly or damselfly species in 2019. So they'll last right through September, as long as the good weather holds, maybe even into October. So absolutely, we're still looking for all dragonfly and damselfly records. You just go online to biodiversityireland.ie, click on the Dragonfly Ireland button and record your sightings and submit your picture if you have it.
Details on the website rte.ie/Mooney to make it easier for you. I was going to say, you really do love dragonflies, don't you?
Do you know what? When I started this job, if a dragonfly hit me in the head, I wouldn't have known what it was.
Really?
I was not a dragonfly expert. I mean, I was a whale and dolphin expert and a marine expert, and I also do marine recording at the data centre. So dragonflies were a new thing for me. But since I've started doing the survey and validating the records and getting to know the species, they're fascinating, absolutely fascinating animals, incredibly beautiful animals. I mean, the more you see them, the more you're bedazzled by their bright colours and their interesting behaviour. And they're a species that very much grabs the public imagination. That's one of the reasons they're very useful as a bioindicator, because people notice them and they like to record them when they see them.
Well, good luck with the work, Dave. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Now, the detrimental impact of plastic pollution on marine life has been brought into sharp focus by the world's media and programmes like Mooney Goes Wild, and in particular our special about the Bergen whale. Scientists found between 30 and 40 plastic bags inside the stomach of this whale, which was stranded off the Norwegian coast. Here's a clip from that documentary.
Well, the interesting thing is that this wasn't the first whale that ever came to our shores. This happens every other year, maybe perhaps with an Olympic interval, but this time was the first time that such a magnificent creature, which they are, and which people come to Norway to see after all as tourists, it was the first time a whale came here, and it became apparent that we killed it, actually. It came here and it came into a small little beach just outside Bergen, and very publicly was put down with a rifle in front of a lot of people. And as soon as we opened it, we saw that we had murdered it with plastic. It was so full in its stomach that it had just choked on plastic. And there's no way around this. We killed this poor creature. Magnificent sea creature that should be there to sort of remind us of the excellence of nature. And now had to be put down, go outside an oil refinery, funnily enough. This, of course, caused an outcry, not only in Norway, but in the world, as the media attention would show later.
And of course, it isn't just whales which are affected by marine plastics. A new study shows that seabirds, like the northern fulmar, are being slowly poisoned from birth by ocean plastic pollution. The study has also found, and for the first time, that plastic debris release potentially harmful chemicals into their stomach fluid. The research by Wageningen Marine Research Centre in the Netherlands has also showed that chicks already had plastics inside them, fed to them by their parents for food. Andy Booth is co-author of the study and a senior researcher at the SINPEF Research Institute in Norway, from where he joins us now. Andy, thank you for talking to us today. Tell us a little bit about your study.
The study that we've conducted, it's a collaboration between Wageningen Marine Research in the Netherlands and SINTEF Ocean in Norway. And we've been looking at how chemical additives in plastic materials transfer from the plastic into seabirds. And we've been looking at northern fulmars, and we've been collecting fulmars from the Faroe Islands and doing some studies where we've put this known plastic materials that we've got into collected stomach oil from the birds. And then we've been incubating that and looking at how these chemicals transfer from the plastic into the stomach oil and potentially then further into the food chain.
Now, Andy, I know that you've been doing a lot of work on northern fulmars, which are a bird that looks, for the listeners, looks a bit like a gull, but they're not related to gulls. They're in the same group of birds as the albatrosses. They wander over the open ocean. They take a lot of food from the sea, obviously. You've been finding some very, very interesting, and I must say worrying, things in the young fulmars on the Faroe Islands.
Yeah, in the Faroe Islands, the fulmars are actually a food source for the local or indigenous people that live there. And so it's one of the few areas that you can go and sort of sample these birds. And we've been looking at, over years, some colleagues of ours at Wageningen and Marine Research have been studying the contents, the stomach contents of the birds. They contain quite a range of plastic. So you have the adults are going around, like you said, you know, they wander the oceans and they pick up bits of plastic, mistaking them for food. And then they take these back and sort of feed them to the chicks alongside, you know, real food as well. So you're getting this plastic accumulating in the chicks in the nests.
Well, can I just ask a question of Niall there? Because I know that you're a chemist, Andy, and Niall, you're an ornithologist. So how do the fulmars actually feed the chicks? Is it a case of regurgitation, or are they carrying the food item in their bill, like so, puffins do, for example?
So it's generally with regurgitation. So they'll swallow as much as they can, like a gull would, and they'll come back and they'll sort of, for want of a better word, they throw this back up, or they pass it directly to the beaks of the chicks. So they're accumulating this, you know, as they're foraging over the open ocean. So rather than going and get one item and then coming back with that, they go and get as much as they can and then come back when they're full, more or less. So that's how they do it.
And is it really bad, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, it ranges, obviously. And it's the same pretty much for every species we've looked at for plastic. Some of them have huge amounts in them, some have less. But I mean, it's quite scary, actually, the amounts that you can find. And the Bergen whale is quite a good example of, you can scale that down to different animals, but they can be, you know, pretty much chock full of plastic on the inside in the worst cases.
And Andy, I know,
of course, that's taking up space instead of food, you know, that they should be having.
Yes, and also you've been finding in your research that there's certain chemicals that are leaching out of this plastic as well. Are they having an effect on these birds, and what's causing that?
That's something that we're still in the process of studying. So what we do know is that there's all these chemicals in plastic, and then we know that there's a very established mechanism where the birds eat the plastic, and then it's sat in the gut. What's particularly interesting with fulmars, as opposed to, say, the Bergen whale, is that fulmars have the digestive system has this grinding mechanism. So actually, even larger items of plastic will, over time, in the gut of the of birds, it'll be broken down into smaller and smaller pieces, like, you know, ground down, so that eventually they can pass it. But of course, this grinding process, it makes the particles smaller, but it increases the surface area.
And of course,
it's at the surface of the particles where the chemicals can come out.
And of course, the thing about fulmars, as opposed to other birds, is that they have a very oily substance. I mean, if you ever went to ring fulmars, they can spit this horrible oily slime on top of you. But this oily bit is part of their own digestive system. So their plastic in their stomachs, if you like, is sitting in this oily concoction. And a lot of these chemicals, or some of the chemicals in plastic, will actually be dissolved by this oil, which it mightn't be dissolved in another bird's stomach, which doesn't have this oil. So fulmars are particularly prone to being able to dissolve out these chemicals from the particles of plastic in their stomachs, because they have an oily substrate rather than a different one which other seabirds would have, which makes them even more attacked, because this, if it dissolves out, goes into their bloodstream. It's not just a physical weight in their stomach that fills them up and they can't eat, but they're actually getting into their bloodstream, into their systems around their body, chemicals from the plastic.
That's absolutely right. You've described the process perfectly there. So the chemicals in the plastic, you know, it's this, potentially this huge range, and they all have very different sort of chemical structures. And some of them prefer to stay in the plastic. Some prefer to go into water than be in plastic. And others prefer to go into oily substances like the stomach oil.
Are these chemicals actually having a detrimental effect on these birds, do we know?
That is something that we don't know yet. The first part of the work that we've done has been to establish just how much of a transfer mechanism there is from the plastic to the oil. But of course, the oil is an integral part of the digestive process, and that's what they also use and sort of take up the energy and the nutrients and the vitamins and things that they need to survive. So we know that once it's in the oil, there's a very good chance that it's going to get into the rest of the bird. And then it's about whether the bird has a mechanism for metabolizing those chemicals. Some chemicals organisms can metabolize and get rid of. Others accumulate and can cause toxic effects. And that's what we'd be looking for in the future.
And it can't be doing the Faroe Islanders any good if they're eating chicks that are full of plastic. Okay, they don't eat the stomach contents, but if it has been absorbed into the flesh of these creatures, then it'll go into the Faroe Islanders as well. And that can't be good.
No, exactly. I mean, it's you know, it's an entry point into the food web, as we call it. And of course, humans, we sit in that same food web. If you have these chemicals going into animals, even ones that we don't eat but are further down the food chain, you know, there's the transfer mechanisms for those to get into us as well.
I think what's particularly interesting, and I must say worrying about this, is that fulmars are birds that would tend to forage well away from human civilization. They go out onto the open ocean. So obviously they're still, those waters are still contaminated with plastic. It's not something that just occurs around human habitation. It must be very widespread in the oceans.
The sort of scientific community and the public as well, you know, everyone's sort of been captured in the last, particularly the last 10 years, I would say, about this plastic issue. I remember when I was a kid, it came up in the 80s, went away again, has come back again as a really topical societal concern, really. You know, the information that we're seeing is that, yes, where you have cities and high population density, those are big emission sites, but this stuff is so mobile once it's in the environment that, you know, we're finding it everywhere we've looked, we're finding it.
It really is alarming. I know that some of the statistics on this are really scary. I mean, it's predicted that by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the oceans by weight than fish, which is absolutely staggering. Do you think that this is something that we as a species will be able to tackle or solve?
Yes, I think this is definitely, you know, there's no problem that society has been presented with that we haven't been able to deal with. And of course, if you think about it, it's very simple. We just need to make sure that plastic does not get into the environment. Sounds easy, of course, but it's much more difficult. And I think, you know, we have this this history of identifying, you know, or making chemicals, using chemicals, and then identifying them as a problem. And then historically, what we've done at that point is we've looked for new versions of chemicals, we've replaced them, we've phased them out. I think the problem with plastic is that we use it in so much of our lives. You just, you know, just look around you now and think everything that you can see, how much of that has got some sort of polymer coating or is made of a plastic. It's everywhere, and that's the big challenge with this, is how we move from a society where we literally use plastic on everything to being able to maintain our use of plastic, but closing those gaps or holes in the sort of life cycle of plastic that allows it to get into the environment.
Because you mentioned the life cycle, and of course, one of the original selling points for plastic is its durability. That life is a very long life cycle.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is, going back to these chemicals, is that some of the chemicals that are added to plastics are specifically designed to increase the length or durability. You know, so you have antioxidants and UV stabilizers that protect the plastic from degrading so quickly. So we're doing even more to make these materials as durable as possible.
Yeah, I remember chlorine used to be one as well, and we had PVC, polyvinyl chlorine, and they were all the welly boots and things that were nice and bendy, and they wouldn't break and shatter the way other plastics would. So, I mean, that had got phased out, didn't it, PVC?
Well, PVC we still use. It's used a lot in things like pipes. I'm not sure of all the applications, but of course, where we've used it has changed. And I think you're probably right with the Wellington boots or the rubber boots, that if they were made of PVC, that will have changed now to a different material.
And have you identified, are there any particular plastics that are commonly in use that are worse than others? And is there anything that that the listeners to this programme can do to help and try and address the usage of those?
Definitely. And actually, quite a good question after the previous comment. PVC in particular is one of the worst. It contains up to 50%, in some cases, additive chemicals and fillers. And that one, in the toxicology tests that we've done on other species, that particular material is one that usually comes out pretty high. Another one that's quite interesting as well is car tire rubber, which is also grouped loosely under this family of plastic materials, particularly when we think of microplastic. And car tire rubber or vehicle tire rubber is also produces quite a lot of chemicals that are toxic.
So is rubber not rubber anymore from the rubber trees? Is it actually a plastic now?
It is rubber, but we class it in environmental sciences. We include it in the microplastic class of pollutants, most typically, along with things like paint flakes. And there's a number of different unusual classes of materials that we group under the broader term plastic or microplastic.
Will we ever get on top of this situation, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of research funding calls coming out that are looking for trying to tackle this problem in all sorts of different places. So we've just been developing a proposal, actually, that's been looking at how we can move away from using fossil fuels as the primary source to produce plastic to more bio-based sources. So that's a help in terms of sort of CO2 emissions, which is something we haven't really touched on here. But of course, we are starting to look for new additive formulations that are less of a risk. We're looking at improved recycling. So, and one of the problems now, again, these chemicals can be a problem in that when you come to recycle plastics, those materials with lots of chemicals in them are much harder to recycle. So we're in the process of developing chemical recycling processes that pull out the chemicals from the plastic. Those chemicals can then be recycled themselves, and the plastic in its cleaner form can be recycled more easily.
We have to recycle. You can't just discard the litter and the rubbish, you know. We just can't do it anymore. We have to stop.
Yeah, we do. And we can all, this is something we can all contribute with. And, you know, it's a bit similar to the sort of climate change issue. You know, you can sit in your own home and think, well, it's just one plastic bag or one single use item of plastic, and think of all the millions and billions that other people are using. But if everyone thinks that way, no change will happen. So we've all got to just take that second to think, do I need this? Is there an alternative where there's less plastic? Because it is an amazing material. We shouldn't, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm very positive to plastic. It's allowed us as a civilization to come so far in technology development in the last 100 years. And I think that's not necessarily acknowledged or appreciated as much as it should be. So we can't get rid of plastic. We've just got to use it in a more sustainable and responsible way.
Well, Andy, thank you very much indeed for speaking with us today. Very much appreciated.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Very valuable research, it has to be said.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've done a lot of research into what's happening with plastics in our oceans, because it's very rare that you find a seabird in Ireland that doesn't have plastic in it. If you just take plastic bottles, drinking bottles for water or soft drinks or whatever, if globally 20,000 of those are produced every single second. So that means every minute.
Every second.
So Derek, every minute that's 1.2 million. And every year, that's over half a trillion plastic bottles, only 7% of which are ever recycled. And a huge number of those end up in our oceans. And that's just plastic bottles. This is a really, really big problem. I know a lot of research has been done here in Ireland into seabirds.
Yeah, you brought in a most wanted poster with you.
Yes, there's a researcher, Dr. Heidi Akampora, who's from GMIT. She's been doing research now for several years.
We spoke to her on the programme some years ago.
She's absolutely brilliant.
About her work, actually.
And the work she does is she analyses the stomach contents of seabirds that are found dead to assess what kind of plastic contamination there is there. So she's asking anybody who happens to find a dead seabird on a beach, there's been a few in the last couple of weeks because of the recent storms, to report them to her so that she can then analyse the stomach contents. It's not necessarily that these birds have died because of the plastic pollution, but she's able to then analyse the stomach contents to find out what's going on. So I know you have the details up on the Mooney Goes Wild website now.
But we've got to be very mindful of how we dispose of our waste and always, where possible, recycle. Thank you very much indeed, Niall. Now it's time to catch up with Terry Flanagan. And Terry, it's all about moths this week at Orison Uachtaráin. Explain.
Yes, Derek. The President asked the OPW, that's the Office of Public Works, to commission a year-long biodiversity audit of the estate. And since late last year, I've been tagging along with the scientists from Trinity College Dublin under the leadership of Dr. Evan Cochrane. In that time, we've broadcast a number of reports. Well, the most recent audit was of the moths. Now, I know that moths are often seen as annoying little creatures that can eat holes in your clothes. But scientists realise that moths play a vital role as overnight pollinators of a wide range of flowers and plants. And with the decline of our bees and bumblebees, it's really important that we keep track of these nighttime flying insects. So, late one evening, I met up with the team and Dr. Ferdy Marnell to set up a number of moth traps throughout the grounds.
So a moth trap is effectively a box with a bright UV light, ultraviolet light, on the top, and it attracts moths from a fair distance around. We're not sure exactly how far and wide they go, but we'd expect to find quite a few moths here. We're in a bit of woodland here in the estate, and I'd expect there to be quite a few different species of moths around. So they're attracted to the UV light, and then they go and they hide in the box underneath.
Now, looking inside the box, you have empty egg cartons.
We do, yeah.
What's that for?
Well, it gives the moth somewhere to sit and to hide. So they actually crawl in under the egg cartons or down into the pockets of the egg carton. And when we come back tomorrow morning to have a look at it, we'll take out the egg cartons one by one and see what we found, if anything. It's supposed to be a mild night, which is a good time to go surveying for moths. And it's going to be dry, so we're hopeful.
Okay, and we're in just the edge of woodland. I'm looking around me here. It's probably ash and beech and the likes. Is this a particularly good habitat for moths?
It should be. So there's a good understory of vegetation, and there's plenty of mature trees, and that's a good combination. So, you know, there are several hundred species of moths in Ireland, and they all have particular food plants that they feed on. So the larvae feed on particular leaves of particular roots or particular shoots of particular species, and then the adults normally don't feed at all. They just fly around looking to mate, to lay eggs back on the food plant, and it starts all over again. So the more different types of food plants you have in the area that you're trapping, the more moth species you're likely to pick up. So this should be a good spot.
And how many species would you hope to catch tonight?
Well, in my own little suburban back garden, I've been only catching five or six different species on a good night. Here in this sort of habitat, I'd be hoping we were getting maybe 25 species per trap, and there'd be overlap. We're hoping to put out three traps tonight. So if we had 30 or 40 species tomorrow morning, I'd be a happy camper.
So we come back in the morning and check?
Yeah, I hope I'm not setting the bar too high now.
So you put out three traps and you left them overnight. How did you get on?
Well, to be honest, I wondered if some foxes or badgers might be attracted to the light from the boxes and disturb them. But no, they were all intact the next morning. And just after dawn, I met up with Ferdia and the rest of the team to see what we had trapped.
What's this one here?
You want to get this
one here?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the one I was...
Oh, wow, yeah. What a spot.
Very,
so
very
gorgeous looking
there. So, Ferdia, you've just gone through your three trap boxes. Are you happy?
A bit disappointed, but it's the first session now. So yeah. It was, to get a proper audit here, you'd need to come back at least once every couple of weeks, right through the year, ideally, because yeah. There are moths that'll turn up in December that are gone by February, you know. So we've picked up a good baseline, but I'd expect there to be a lot more moths hanging around here. We just need to come back and try again.
When we left last night, the last thing you said was maybe 25 or 30 species. I know you're only just topping them up, but do you think, have you hit the 25 or 30?
I don't think so. No, we've a few that have to be identified. So there's some micro moths, so there's the small moths, which take a bit of identification, so you need a hand lens. Or what we have been doing is we've been taking photographs and then sort of zooming in on the photographs, but you need a good book. And usually the backup of an expert to be really confident about identifications for the micros.
You're talking about micros, and I presume there's macros. Is it just a case of their size?
Almost, yeah. There's a couple of weird ones that are included in the micros that are actually larger than some of the ones that are included in the macros. So it's not completely based on size. So there's some family groups that have been swapped from one to the other and stuff like that. But it seems to be an historical thing, and that's just the way that people use it now. But the macros tend to be bigger. So they're often as big as butterflies, for example.
Yeah. You mentioned butterflies. There's only something like, 30 or 40 species of butterflies in Ireland. Yeah. But there are thousands of species of moths. Why is that so?
We have a great variety of moths. I don't know why, that's a good question, why there's so many more moths. I think we were talking about the food plants. So I mean, moths will feed on different individual types of foods, plant. It's almost always just the larva, the caterpillar stage, that feeds, and quite often the adults never feed at all. So when they emerge, they're really just planning on breeding, laying eggs, and then they die. So the adult phase is quite short. And some people specialise in just identifying the caterpillars. So we haven't been doing that. We've just been focusing on the flying adults here, because that's what's attracted to the moth traps, to the UV lights.
What is the role of the moth in the ecosystem? We know the butterfly, we know the bee, they're interested in pollination. The moths are nocturnal, they come out at night. Where do they fit into it all?
Yeah, well, there are nocturnal flowers, some evening-scented flowers, night-scented flowers that moths are often attracted to. So they do play a role in pollination as well. They're very important food for bats in particular, and evening birds like swallows and swifts. They will feed a lot on moths. There's daytime flying moths as well. So they've actually very broad spectrum in terms of the ecosystem. And then obviously the caterpillars are very important in terms of breaking down detritus and vegetation and dead leaves. But they also feed on live plants as well. So they have a very important role in that.
Because in general, people don't think of them very, very highly. I mean, you think of them, they've got a bad press. The moths, the mothballs, they eat your clothes and so on.
Yeah, there's about two species or three species that turn up in people's houses that can be a bit of a pest.
Yeah.
And then there's about 1,000 species that live outside people's houses that never go near people's houses. And it wasn't really till I started trapping them that I realised the variety that is available, even in your typical back garden. So there's huge variety, and some of them are big, you know, they're much bigger than our biggest butterflies, things like the hawk moths. The poplar is the biggest one, and I'm surprised we didn't find that actually, because that's flying at the moment, and I suspect if we come back here again in another few weeks, we should pick up some more species.
So give us a ballpark figure. I know you haven't added them all up yet, but are you talking about 20 different species tonight?
Yeah, if we can identify all the micros, and sometimes that's very hard to do without actually dissecting them, then we probably are up about 20, yeah. But in theory, I mean, in a state like this, that's as big as this, and that has so much variety of habitat, we should be well over 100 species.
So it's back again later on for more?
Yeah, well, I think we'd have to be back a couple more times. If we want to get a proper breakdown of what's here, we need to trap several times into the autumn.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Niall. Thank you, Aina. That's pretty much all we have time for today. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. And our producer is Anna Letty. Until next week, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.